Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
So it's my pleasure to be joined on the G word today by Professor Ewan Ashley, who's the Professor of Medicine and Genetics at Stanford University, and who has just published a wonderful book called The Genome Odyssey. Ewan, welcome to the pod.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You're joining us from quarantine in Scotland, which is very kind of you. And I have to say, for those listening, you're wearing a wonderful T-shirt that just says, "Because science." I think that we should be handing these out to political and business leaders all over the world. And,
seems about right for this time in history. Yeah,
absolutely. Ewan, you have, you know, you've had this incredibly storied career. You've won a ton of awards and you hold a bunch of important positions. Give us a little bit of a sense of how did you go from growing up in Scotland as a kid to being in the Bay Area now, doing the range of things that you're doing?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I was kind of born to be a doctor in some ways. I grew up in a medical family. I'm actually in the house I grew up in right now. And my dad was a GP here locally, my mom, a midwife. And they used to take me out on house calls. And, you know, I just, from my earliest memories, wanted to be a doctor. But as I was growing up as a teenager, I also was, you know, quite definitively a nerd. And I got a ZX Spectrum computer and learned how to program BASIC and did a whole bunch of nerdy things as a kid. And so
I had the +2. I'm getting visions of the very exciting kind of integrated cassette tape recorder on the right hand side.
You could still hear the audio, can't you, with the program like loading itself in. Yeah, that's burned into my brain. And I played plenty of games, as I'm sure you did too. But I also started to find programming interesting. Talking to computers was just kind of an interesting thing. And so I went to medical school in Glasgow. Headed down south and did a PhD after my junior house jobs in Oxford. And then I think I got my first taste of California and really Silicon Valley, which was sort of a mecca almost for the computer nerd inside me, and realized that there was a potential life where you could combine this interest in computers with an interest in health and medicine. And so the first year I was there, it was when Netscape was having its IPO. It was just the very early point in the taking off of the internet. And as I was working through my PhD at Oxford, I was really thinking, well, it could be really interesting to go back to California. And when I arrived there, really the high throughput biomedical science, which is to say the microarray originally, which was partially invented at Stanford, was just taking off. So we were going from a molecular biology where you measured three or four things to a data science where you would measure 2,000, then 20,000. And then as genome sequencing came online, of course, we moved to millions and billions of data points. And I think just being in the sort of right place at the right time with the right kind of nerdy interests was what led to my interest in genomics and genome science. I mean, to an extent, I had been introduced to genetics. My biology teacher in high school and secondary school he thought I was fairly useless and wouldn't ever amount to anything. That was the most important thing he told my parents, but he did actually.
Inspirational teachers we have known.
Yes, exactly. But I should also thank him because, two things. I used to talk to him a bit about jazz. He was quite into music, and I know you are as well. But he also handed me a copy of Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene when I was about 14 years old. So that planted a seed, and particularly planted a seed even in thinking about writing a book, because the lucidity of Dawkins writing about biology was just immense, just off the charts. And his sense of wonder for the biological world and the natural world was amazing to me in a way that my biology teacher and really the other teachers perhaps were not bringing to life. And so I guess all of those things came together around the opportunity to be and live at Stanford in the Bay Area. I was very surprised to be offered a job when I finished my training there and have been there. We'd expected to be there for a few years, 3 or 4 at most. And it's now, I think, almost 20 years later, and we're still there having fun.
Time flies. And tell us a little bit about the mix of things that you've done over those 20 years. I mean, you've got your own team. You've been engaged, as I guess is almost a legal obligation in the Bay Area, with various tech startups as well. what's the give us a sense of how that's played out.
No, that's kind of the right way to put it, because I think it's the culture of starting up companies is really kind of, really in the water at Stanford, and you don't need to swing a cat too far to hit another faculty member there who has started a company. And so it's definitely the idea of having an idea in your lab and then moving it out into the world is definitely something that is familiar to many. I think that as genome sequencing came online, and she will get into that as we talk a little bit more about some of the stories in the book, the lab that I was running kind of evolved to take account of that. At the beginning, there was a wet lab component, and it was still there. We still do now increasingly genome engineering in the wet lab. But the computational side of the lab was what really took off. And I think that the power of computing and being able to apply computer science to the large scale data that comes out of genome sequencing was really the opportunity that we jumped on. And I just found incredibly valuable, fascinating, and also just the transformative power of being able to sequence the human genome, which just really struck a chord with me. I mean, not only because maybe here was a way to understand at some level humanity, but much more importantly, I think here's a way to start to understand diseases that we currently had no handle on. And it seemed very clear that computing was going to help us get there. And so that's kind of where the lab came together.
And there's kind of a journey, I guess, for all science, from an idea, a set of questions, this kind of curiosity-led science, which is driven by understanding how the world works, how the body works, how science works, through to being able to think about how that might be applied in either a business context or a medical clinical context, maybe in a product, or as you say, in a spin-out company. There's an amazing story in the book around that not being a gradual process in your context, but actually a very sudden process of going from almost a sort of academic question to a very human application. Tell us a little bit about the story around the first medical interpretation of a whole human genome.
Yeah, well, like most things, I think it was very much just, it was unexpected. And I think it was very much a kind of serendipitous thing. I was basically having a meeting with someone I didn't know that well at the time, but he was pretty famous already, a guy called Steve Quake, who's now a very good friend. But at the time, I didn't know him that well. He was the chair of bioengineering at Stanford. He'd invented little microfluidic circuits and also some sequencing technology. And I went over to meet him to discuss something else, basically a seminar. And I found him in an office on the second floor of this pretty modern building at Stanford. And I had to search it out to find him. And then when I got there, he was basically sitting amidst all these piles of journals and pecking away at his keyboard. And rather than talk about the thing we were supposed to talk about, he kind of pulled me over to his computer and said, "Hey, take a look at this." And on the screen was one of these old HTML tables, like an early website. And scrolling through were a whole bunch of A, T, C's, and G's, basically the letters of a genome. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, but what is that? And he's like, "Well, that's my genome." And this was, I was like, "What? This is your?" I mean, and at some level, I knew that you know, this was something he was doing, sequencing his genome. In fact, it turned out when he published that, he was just the fifth person in the world ever to have a genome sequenced.
I was going to say, in 2010, this was not a routine procedure, right?
It was not. And in fact, the few that had come before that were all basically large teams, many, many months or years, and many, many millions of dollars. And the thing that marked out his genome was that he did it with two people in his lab over the course of about a week for about $50,000, which at the time was tenfold less than the prior one. So it was a remarkable thing. But at the time, just to put it in perspective, we did genetic testing in our clinic. But just to be clear, you know, we were sending perhaps a test that had three genes on it, and that might take 3 months to come back. And it would certainly cost, you know, $5,000, maybe more. And so the idea that somebody could be sitting there, like scrolling through his genome, was just mind blowing, you know. And then the conversation took a slightly different turn, because he started pointing at specific genes and specific variants. And he pointed at one gene with a longish name, myosin binding protein C, but basically a gene that was familiar to me because I knew that it caused a genetic disease of the heart muscle called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that was also could be associated with even sudden death. That was a pretty serious disease potentially. And so I just rather casually started to ask him some questions about his family history. And initially, like most people, he said, no, I don't have any family history of any diseases, because who can remember anyway? I mean, that's the usual. But then he thought a bit more and he sort of said, actually, I've come to think of my dad as a heart thing, some kind of rhythm called ventricular, you couldn't quite remember. And I said tachycardia, and he's like, yeah, that's it. This being a potentially fatal rhythm of the heart muscle. And then I asked him if anyone had in his family had ever died suddenly, which is the classic question for this condition. And he said, well, yeah, actually, as it turns out, my cousin's son, 19-year-old, black belt in martial arts, just didn't wake up one morning, which is just a tragedy. But all of a sudden, the conversation changed. And we, instead of like two scientists talking about a genetics seminar, which is what we were supposed to be doing, we were scrolling through his genome and had moved to the point where it was very clear he needed to be screened in the clinic. He needed to come. And he said, yeah, you know, my family have been telling me I should go and get screened and I should see a cardiologist. And well, here was one sitting in front of him. And so I invited him to the clinic and he said, okay. And we pulled some strings. And, you know, a week later, he walked into our clinic essentially as the first patient ever to have his genome available. And the scary part about that a little bit for us was it was our clinic he was walking into. And you know, we had a patient walking in with a genome. And what were we going to do with that? Because, you know, we were used to sending a cholesterol panel with 4 or 5 numbers on it. And suddenly here was a patient walking in with 6 billion letters, 6 billion data points that could potentially speak to any number, hundreds, thousands of diseases. And so that was really a turning point. And what came next is what we describe, of course, in the book. And it was an incredible adventure for us.
And only a decade on from then, you know, with projects like the 100,000 Genomes Project in the UK, UK Biobank, All of Us, which is gearing up in the States and so on, we take for granted, I guess, that not only the data is available, but also that the knowledge base is available, that we can look at all of the previous interpretations of the genome, of which this was literally the first in a clinical context. How did you even start that process with the, as you say, you've locked into this one gene that's got him into the clinic in the first place. What else did you even think to look at?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the right question and exactly the right point. I mean, now we take for granted we can access 100,000 people's genomes through, you know, Genomics England, through the NOMAD program and others that some of your listeners may be familiar with, kind of at the click of a mouse. But at the time, there were none. I mean, there were two, basically, that we could access: the Human Genome Project.
One of which was Watson, right?
Yes, right. Craig Venter. And actually, Watson's wasn't that easy to access. But yeah, Craig Venter's was, and the Human Genome Program, of course, was. And that was really about it. So yeah, we were flying fairly blind from the perspective of what do these variants mean. But there were some certain principles that we certainly did not invent, but there were, part of sort of the central dogma, the larger part of the, you know, how do genes work? We could, there are ways you can look through a genome and say, well, this is a start of a gene, this is a stop. And if you see a stop where it shouldn't be, that's something that you can interpret about that gene. There were some lists, actually. There's a database still going, I think, that was based out of Cardiff, of all places. And, it's still used. And they were one of the first places to start to accumulate variants on diseases. So we were able to look at that, although certainly at the time, there were just a huge number of there was a lot of uncertainty around the validity of those because it was really just skunk works at the beginning, you know, just people really working together. Yeah. But But yeah, so there was a few different things that we were lucky. We did a pharmacogenomics was something that we focused on, the idea of using the genome to try and help with drug prescribing, medication prescribing. And actually at Stanford was housed the, and still is, the kind of Bible for pharmacogenomics, a database of DNA variants and their effect on medications that are commonly prescribed. So we were able to tap into that. And when I was thinking of trying to put together a team that would help, two of the close colleagues that I pulled in, Russ Altman, who worked very closely with the PharmGKB, this pharmacogenomics database, and Atul Butte, who had been building a database from the common variants, so the genome-wide association studies, of which a prominent one at the time was the Wellcome Trust. The UK has really been at the forefront of genomics from the beginning. I brought them in because they had those databases, just exactly as you mentioned, even in embryonic form.
And at a human level, I guess, how did that play out for patient number one?
Yeah. Well, we ended up calling it patient zero.
The infinite.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's mathematically not exactly right. Although computer scientists always, of course, start at zero. They never start counting at one. So I guess that's probably why he became zero. But he himself, of course, was part of the team. So it was this very unusual situation where we pulled together this big group, and there were three or four from each of the three or four groups. So we ended up with a large, you know, there were about 20 or 30 of us at times. We had ethicists involved as well early on. And then the sequencing team was led by Steve himself, and he was the patient. So he was in some of these meetings saying, what do we do with a genome? And, oh, by the way, it's yours. You know. And so when we were batting about, well, maybe is this variant important, is this one not, he was often in those meetings. And so it led for made for some very unusual scientific discussion. But he was, you know, another advantage, though, was that, of course, he wanted to hear everything. He wanted to know everything. And although it's certainly true that he wasn't necessarily, where would he have had knowledge of clinical genomics, but he had plenty of knowledge, of course, of genetics. And so was in a privileged position to understand the interpretations that we were talking through. But that for us was the foundation of how we would deal with also transmitting to an individual, like talking about genomic data with an actual individual, albeit an unusually qualified one. But certainly the foundation that we now use to discuss genomic data with patients, it was actually built then. It's very similar. That framework was the one we came up with for patient zero. So
wow. And in his case, he had not had any symptoms before that, right? But a lot of the other stories that you talk about in the book, and we use this phrase, the sort of the diagnostic odyssey, to talk about how long and painful some people's journey can be before they get a diagnosis. I'm sure there must be too many patient stories to choose from, but maybe tell us a little bit about how we can use these techniques to, I love the metaphor you use in the book around sort of almost like Sherlock Holmes, kind of solve the mystery of what's going on with people who've really often been suffering for a very long time.
Yeah, and in fact, I think probably my wife would probably tell you I got a bit too obsessed with Sherlock Holmes when I was writing this book, but I really was struck by a number of the parallels. I didn't even know Conan Doyle himself was a doctor originally, and I certainly didn't know that he based the character of Sherlock Holmes on a surgeon from Edinburgh, who was actually Queen Victoria's surgeon. So there's all sorts of fascinating things. And then I bet the parallels in the books between medicine and crime prevention were very many. And so they follow through. And you know, as you say, these early genomes were from people without symptoms, certainly with family history in each case. But the place where the genome has really had this massive impact over the last decade has been in rare disease, and in particular patients with undiagnosed disease who are on, as you mentioned, these medical odysseys, often for years and years, and going from doctor to doctor to doctor, just accumulating emotional and financial burden without answers. And the genome is such a powerful tool to solve those cases, and solving them by itself is incredibly powerful. I think when we write papers and send them to scientific journals, they're often saying, well, what's the actionability? That's this word that, you know, I've never had a patient talk to me about actionability, because they want answers, and they believe that the, you know, finding the diagnosis, solving the cases, is allows them to gain control. They now know what this is. The enemy has a name, often a support group, other patients, other families, and they can start working on answers, even whereas I think the medical establishment wants the answer already. It's like, what's the point solving the condition if you don't immediately have a treatment? But of course, for a patient, that's, it's a huge difference between not knowing and knowing the answer. And so,
I was really struck, actually, just to your point about the power of diagnosis even before you get to treatment. I think it's so powerful. I was really struck with the mother of one of our patient participants in the 100,000 Genomes Project, who was kind enough to do a video about her experiences, the family's experiences through that, when she was talking about getting a diagnosis for Owen, her son. She started crying and she said, "Look, it was only at that moment that I felt this incredible relief and I realized how guilty I'd been feeling because I thought it was my fault." And in Owen's case, this was down to a, you know, what we call a de novo mutation. So a mutation that's not inherited from your mum or your dad, but it's just in you. You know, we as human beings are so kind of complex like that, right? That it's only at that moment that she realized this burden of guilt that she'd been implicitly feeling in the background and then was suddenly released from it at that moment of feeling that. And as you say, there's then support groups and so on, and there's something you can do. Whereas there's that sense of just almost being in a dream before that, of being having heavy arms or like not really being able to do anything. It's incredibly empowering.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. And we hear that from so many family members. And I think your point is very well taken. Often they don't realize that they're under that stress. And I mean, they know they're stressed, but I think they don't realize to the extent to which they've been feeling it. And we, you know, I make this point with some of the family stories in the book, you know, whether it's bad genes or good genes, of course it's variants, not genes, but you know, you get it all from your parents. And that's true whether you have a disease in your family or not. I mean, we all inherit all the good things and the bad things. And then we are also, you know, subject to the environments that we're brought up in. And so, yeah, no, I think that's very true. And what one of the stories in particular that comes to mind, just saying that, I talk about a little bit, two thirds of the way through the book, comes from the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, which is this network of experts around the US and connects nationally and internationally, also including with 100,000 Genomes, for sharing data. And these are two little boys, Carson and Chase, who were initially developing normally. They were first, Carson was the older one who was born, and then he developed normally up to about one. And so he was starting to cruise, starting to walk around, like those who are parents will recognize that stage, but then started to slip back. And so instead of moving on to walking, he slipped back and started crawling again, and then was suddenly not able to feed himself anymore. And intellectually, he was progressing normally, but his movements were abnormal. And so they started to go to doctor after doctor after doctor, specialist after specialist, and didn't find an answer. And then when his brother came along and suffered the same progression and then regression, basically, on his motor skills, they realized it must be a genetic disease and then started to see geneticists. But it's still, they saw two or three before eventually they were sent to the Undiagnosed Diseases Network. And this is really the power of the genome. They'd even had these exomes, so the 2% of the genome that is codes for the proteins, they'd even had that done. So quite a sophisticated genetic test had already been done with no answer. And when they came to our Undiagnosed Diseases Network program, basically there were, we sequenced all four of the family members. And so we were able to pick up, using the power of a whole genome on four family members, the answer, which just wasn't obvious from only testing one with an exome. And so they became the eighth and ninth boys in the world to be diagnosed with this condition called Meepan syndrome. And I think, just to the point that kicked off the story, I think Nikki and Danny, the boys' mom and dad, had really, they'd spent so many hours up late at night, racked with guilt, first of all, that maybe they had caused this through passing on these genes, but also they had spent a great deal of time up at night trying to find answers and trying to solve this for themselves. And the reality was, one of the most amazing things to me about all the stories in the book was that part of the answer was actually a supplement in the end, once you worked out what the pathway was. And that supplement was actually available on Amazon. It wasn't even a prescription. It was a supplement that was basically three clicks away on the internet at night. And actually, when they started taking it, they were significantly improved their motor control, and did, it wasn't a miracle cure, of course, but they started to significantly improve. So I think the power of the answer is often that it gives that relief and that release, but then also it allows an arrow to point towards a potential therapy and a potential treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's transformative in that context for those people. And I'd love to maybe just broaden the the aperture a bit and just think about some of the other ways that this science, genomics, and its kind of application in medicine is changing and is actually over time, I guess, transforming how we do medicine. We've talked about diagnosis. There's also lots of activity going on in kind of prediction and prevention, more into kind of the common disease areas and so on. This is maybe a difficult question to answer succinctly on a podcast, but if we think over the next kind of 5 to 10 years, as this information is becoming more and more part of the mainstream of medicine, how can we see that changing, I guess, both the experience of patients, but also the experience of doctors?
I think the genome has a phenomenal run still ahead of it, right? I think it's not going anywhere. The impact has been, as we've talked so far, in rare disease to date, and there's still, I think, a lot of work to be done there with new technologies. And I think we can solve 40% of these cases, but you know, that's the, what about the other 60%? So we've got a lot of work still to do there. But I do think the next decade we'll see the genome move from this position as a real technology that can help with rare disease to one that's much more mainstream, and in particular to move from a reactive position to more of a preventive position. I think we've been using this phrase recently, preventive genomics, which is, I think, what we're looking towards to the future. And we think, as you mentioned, about common diseases. So we think about rare disease being collectively common. 1 in 10, 1 in 15 people has a rare disease. So collectively very common. But still there are diseases like, of course, cancer and heart disease that are the biggest killers in our society and that almost everyone is touched by those. So what can the genome bring there? Well, a lot is the answer. I mean, in lots of ways, of course, we think about early detection, and that starts with risk. And there are these scores, polygenic scores, that can help us think about what our risk is. But for cancer, of course, there's now testing, that liquid biopsy testing that you might have heard, but a blood test that can potentially pick up cancer early. And so I think that in many ways, the genome is just getting started in terms of the impact it can have on future medical care.
And as that's coming in, obviously this is a big part of medical training today. In fact, the very first guest we had on this podcast was Eric Topol, who was saying he was advocating that every medical student today should be sequencing their own genome and using it through their medical course. We've had another guest who's talked about retraining people being a bit like sort of fitting air conditioning into a building that wasn't built with it. It's like sort of quite a difficult and painful undertaking. Right. How should we think about bringing the whole kind of medical community with us as well, so it's not just specialists, but is something that is seen as I guess core to practice across all of those different disciplines that you've just mentioned?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of points there. Of course, it's going to be important to be educated, and to Eric's point, I guess there's nothing that motivates you more to understand something than if it's about yourself. So Stanford had a course early on where genotyping was offered. I know Mount Sinai had a course early on where sequencing was offered, and so I definitely endorse that as one possibility. I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to be the standard. But I think there's also a point whereby it's not clear that all doctors need to know technical information about the genome. They clearly need to understand the genome is here and need to understand that it can impact medicine. But in the same way that we don't, I often use the pharmacogenomics we talked about earlier, the effect of the genome on drug and prescribing, as a good example, because we, as medical students, will all learn that some drugs are metabolized through the kidney, some are like metabolized through the liver, but your GP doesn't need to be able to write out the full metabolic pathway for every drug. And in the same way, they don't need to be able to tell you which assembly platform was used and which variant calling algorithm was used. And what they need to do is understand that there are sources that you can get really highly accurate genome information from reputable labs, and then know what to do with that. And I think one of the examples that we've done some work recently with another British company, Genomics PLC, Peter Donnelly's company, and thinking about their approach to polygenic risk scores. Well, our sense, and shared by them, is that we can't separate the genome. You can't separate nature and nurture, because we're both of those things all together. And our current scores, at least risk scores, at least in the US, where it's slightly different from here in the UK, but they're based on standard things like cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure. Your standard score for your risk of a heart attack doesn't include even a question about family history. So there's literally no nature aspect right now to the score for your risk of having a heart attack. And that's how you decide, say, to have a cholesterol medication or a blood pressure medication. And now we have this opportunity not just to know a bit about family history, but to know in quite a lot of detail about your genetic risk. So, of course, our view is that those should be brought together in an integrated score so that both are accounted for in your overall risk. And so that, I think, is part of the future. And exactly how that comes together is not something necessarily that your GP needs to know, but they need to know it's based on valid data and that it's a more precise estimate of your patient's chance of having a heart attack than the one that doesn't have that genetic information. And that being the case, I think they can have confidence to move forward and start to integrate it into practice.
Yeah. And one of the ideas that we're exploring at the moment at Genomics England is the potential patient benefit from sequencing newborn kids. And actually, this brings together a couple of these themes, because one of the reasons you would do that, and this is probably the first wave of what you would do, is to screen for individually rare conditions, which, as you say, collectively are common, which are highly penetrant in that if you have that glitch in your DNA, you will almost certainly have the effect in the body and are treatable in very early life. And so there's a kind of immediate clinical benefit for kids who are born with those conditions. But then there's this sort of second angle on this, which says, right, well, you're born, your parents have chosen to opt into this program, and you can make that choice again when you're 16 or 18. And this information is now on file. And so you use this phrase preventative genomics. We just talked a bit about understanding the risk of things like heart disease or particular types of cancer better through using the genome to predict those things. What other areas are you interested in preventative genomics? People have talked a bit about mental health, other things, you know, and then you go all the way through to sort of societal stuff, right? You know,
yeah.
What's your take on this question? What do you think is useful and interesting? What do you think is either we should avoid or kind of legislate against? Or yeah, where do we draw the line? What's good? What's bad?
Right. Yeah. No, big question. And I think, though, you laid it out very nicely, and that I think that we have the most confidence about the reversible diseases that you can pick up early, large scale, large effect variants, really important diseases. Obviously, we could sometimes call them Mendelian. I think then as you go through life, there are these more common diseases, as we talked about, like cancer and heart disease. Those are the two biggest killers in most of the developed and developing world. And there's a lot we can say for both of them, and there's a lot that we can do for both of those. And I think most people would want to, but that is something that happens a bit later in life. Although there's a point at which it doesn't matter much because everybody's going to die of something. So what we found with the polygenic risk scores is that they're most effective at that point in middle age or sooner, when you actually have a chance to prevent disease going forward. So that, I think that's really important. By the time you get a bit older, age is the single most important determinant of everything, basically. So, and then, you know, as you say, there are many other interesting areas where genomics will come to affect care. One of the things that's, of course, top of everybody's mind right now is pathogens. And, you know, sequencing has been such an important part of our response to the pandemic. From the first time the sequence of the SARS-CoV-2 was released by the Chinese Health Authority, there were diagnostic tests almost immediately, the genomic vaccines that we're all being protected by increasingly, thankfully, all came from that sequence. Our ability to track variants, once again, the UK is at the forefront of sequencing the variants and understanding the differences in caused by selective evolution of the virus. And so I think that will go along with an increasing understanding of both our microbiome, which is another, I think, very interesting area for genomics. It's a little early. We're not quite at the point of using it to treat people, but I think we'll start to look at diversity of microbiome as a really important contributor towards medical care. And then the really interestingly, I think once we start to understand the immune system at a genetic level, so we always have this fun back and forth with the immunologists who tell me, well, everything's the immune system. And, you know, that's at the end of the day. And I say, well, actually, it's all genetics at the end of the day. And we have this fun back and forth. And the reality is that it all comes together. The immune cells rearrange their genomes, essentially, to respond to pathogens and sometimes to respond to self, which is, you know, where autoimmune disease comes from. But increasingly, because of sequencing, we have the ability to assay the immune system at that genetic level. And when that comes together, I think with our understanding of the microbiome, we're going to realize we've been missing a whole like corner of human, not human, but microbiome, human biology, and that interaction between the two is, I think, a land of great opportunity. So I think that's something that we'll come to be talking a lot more about going forward.
Yeah, your mind almost kind of adds a third or fourth dimension to whatever map of the body or of health that we had before, right? Yeah. One of the other things that we worry a lot about is making sure that these advances and these personalized approaches and these preventative approaches are accessible to everyone. We talked before a bit about things like UK Biobank and the 100,000 Genomes Project and NOMAD and so on. One of the issues in these big data sets is that they are predominantly people of European background. I think all of us is doing great work in terms of engaging communities in the States for that big program. How important do you think it is that we bring these different communities, different ancestral groups into the kind of research folds? What will it take to do that, and how will that benefit the field?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely urgent. I think there is nothing more pressing for our field than doing that, making sure that our genomic databases and then that the people who are engaged in putting those together reflect the entirety of the globe. And there's very practical reasons why, but it's just the right thing to do is much more important. But yeah, I think so much of the data we have for all of medicine, but even more so for genetics, has come from those of European backgrounds. And I think that the rest of medicine, I hope, can learn from the fact that genetics can kind of correct the course here and really start to properly reflect global diversity. I don't think anything is more urgent than that. And there's so much to learn. I think that the experience, one of the really fun parts that I hadn't particularly expected as I set out to write the book and tell sort of human patient narratives, but also the scientific stories, was the history of the UK Biobank, for example. John Bell and others were very kind of them. It was kind of them to share the stories from the early days and even from the conversations inside the Oval Office with President Obama. And I think the fact that data sharing was such an important part of that from the beginning, and in the case of all of us, this insistence on diversity, it came right from the top. It came right from the originators of these programs. And so I think we're correcting it. It's going to take a while. One of the points we often make is that we shouldn't pause everything and not roll out genomics to as many people as possible because we don't yet have the global diversity in our background. We should fix both things. We should do both things at the same time, clearly. So, absolutely urgent for our field to do that.
Absolutely. And this conversation is part of a series that we're having at Genomics England to try and surface the way that genomics is changing our lives as it comes into the mainstream. Are there either people or topics who you think don't get enough airtime in these conversations that we should be making sure to talk to, listen to, engage with through these conversations?
Well, I think to speak to just the point we just made is that there are genomic scientists across the world who we can engage. And one of the things that's been very important about the H3 Africa project, just as one example, is that we're not just looking at a very admixed population, so a population that's mixed together, let's say in the United States, but we're actually engaging with scientists and genomic scientists in Africa who are doing that work and bringing them into the sort of global stage so that when we're doing data sharing, which is ultimately, again, I think the genomics community arguably has led the way in data sharing for science, at least for biological science. The physicists were always very good at sharing data, but, you know, for biological science, I think
it's easier with sort of stars and atoms.
Well, they have to share the microscope, so or share the particle accelerator, so they kind of had to share. But biology hasn't been that great sharing, but I do think that the genomics crowd has been good at doing that. And I think we should be able to do that much more on a global basis as groups from various countries around the world come together. So I think, yeah, in terms of Genomics England, I mean, I think really a shining light for the world in terms of the application of the human genome to medicine and bringing this into the healthcare system is it's really something that in the genomics community internationally really admires the work that you're doing, Chris, with the team in the UK. And I'm proud as a UK citizen to, you know, to look towards that. But yeah, so I would hesitate to give you advice, but I think that certainly in engaging the scientists in the place where they are is a good way forward.
I'm loving the shape of the future vision that you're painting for us here, where we're preventative, we're engaging early, detecting diseases early, getting to diagnoses, personalizing the treatments, and we're doing that in a way where we're collaborating globally and we're bringing all of these different communities with us. It's a very exciting picture of the future. Ewan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And best of luck with the rest of your quarantine and with all of your many other endeavors.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure to join you in conversation today.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.